Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Pulp and Paper Radio International. This is our Legends of the Industry series, an audio history of people who have made a difference in the pulp and paper industry worldwide. Well, good morning, and this morning we are interviewing David Ashcraft, a long-term seasoned veteran of the industry, and we're going to hear about his career. So good morning, David. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Jim. I'm doing fine here in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Your favorite place.
Absolutely.
All right. We sent you some questions, so anyone that is listening in, we're not going to trip David up here. We're interested in hearing what's happened in his life. So David, we'll just start down the list. Tell us a little bit about the industry when you started. How has it changed or evolved over the years?
My beginning in the industry goes all the way back to 1964 when I enrolled as a freshman here at NC State. And several things have happened. This was probably 10 to 15 years before the peak of the industry, which some people say occurred in around 1980. But productivity has increased. You go in a mill today, and there are a lot fewer people in the mill than when I first started. A lot more automation. Use of the internet for information as well as marketing and sales. I think there's a greater awareness today by most of those in the mill management, in the management structure particularly, of the mill and its place in the community. And probably the most important thing that's changed is there's a much greater awareness, much greater emphasis on safety, individual safety.
Sure. For folks who aren't familiar with your career, you mentioned starting at NC State in 64. How did you get to NC State? How did you get interested in the pulp and paper industry?
I grew up in a paper mill town, Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And when I was growing up, there were two mills in the town. International Paper had a mill there. And at that time, the mill was called Dirks, which later became Weyerhaeuser. I'm not sure what it is today. So I grew up, as a lot of us did, that grew up around the paper mills, with that peculiar odor of the paper mill. But I was recruited by a local person in the technical department at IP who was familiar with NC State and came here on a pulp and paper scholarship, not knowing really where Raleigh was located or much about the program for that matter. I think I was sold on the industry after my summer experiences, Counts, Tennessee. Back then it was called Tennessee River. Today it's PCA. I worked a summer at Union Camp in Franklin back then. Today it's an IP mill. And then my third summer was with East Tex. Today, Midwest Vaco in Evadale, Texas. And those on-the-job experiences are what really sold me with that industry. I came up to traditional rank through the technical department and then into local mill management and then to the corporate structure.
What do you consider your most significant accomplishments and achievements during your career?
I would hope that most people say that I was fair with employees, with customers, with vendors, suppliers, honest, transparent. I think I allowed people to do their jobs, perhaps to a fault, but delegated areas of responsibility to the people who were in charge of those areas. And then near the end of the career, active career in industry, transforming the mill, which was a 1950s vintage mill, into a modern mill that had a new pulp mill, and it actually has the newest paperboard machine in the world today.
Yes, I've seen that machine. That's quite a machine there at that Evadale. During your career, well, during all of our careers, we have things that stand out, good and bad. Can you give us, maybe you want to remember the good ones, but either way, if you could give us one of each, that'd be great.
I give you one of each. In terms of good, I think labor relations would be one of the goods. I had a personal friendship with Lloyd Young. He was a third hand on one of our paper machines. So I always enjoyed that relationship with Boyd, which continued after he moved on to Nashville, Tennessee. There were lots of the bad things which I try to forget, but probably an example of making wrong decisions. We had a quality problem that we should have taken care of initially. We shipped it to the customer, the product to the customer. Anyhow, the customer rejected it, and that customer lost their customer, and we lost the customer as a result of failing to take the corrective action when we should have. And there are several incidents like that as I look back in my career that had I made the initial decision right the first time, it would have saved many problems down the road.
Often I've found that we think through wishful thinking that something's going to get better that really isn't going to get better, and we have to hit it head on.
Right, and the quicker we do that, the better off we are, but sometimes we don't learn that until we're older.
Could you go up to Washington and explain that principle to them?
I don't think they would listen.
In terms of challenges that perhaps you have run into either during your career or family, inspiring your children, and of course you've spent the last few years at NC State, help us to get some inspiration for perhaps some things that looked insurmountable that you found a way to overcome.
If I give you a personal example first, one of the hardest things for me to do in life is to balance the priorities in my life. I tend to be a workaholic. I enjoy work, always have enjoyed work, continue to enjoy work. And when you're a workaholic, there's certain things that are going to be neglected one way or the other. You're going to neglect family, you're going to neglect God, or you're going to neglect something that should be a part of your life. And one of the things that I probably didn't learn until I was past 50 is that periodically I need to step back, take some quiet time, which is more than an hour, reflect on where I'm spending my time, and then rebalance my priorities. And I've made a point of doing that now on an annual basis. It's almost like rebalancing your stock portfolio. I keep a pretty close account on where I spend my time, and I rebalance that now. The other thing that I've learned through the years is that relationships are so much more important than tasks. And I tend to be very task-oriented. In fact, I will create a to-do list and check the boxes of things that are already done just so I can have a lot of checks on that page. And I've learned that relationships are what count in the long run. And going back through my career, it's those relationships that I remember. It's not the task that I spent the time worrying about at the time. Typically, those things which seemed insurmountable, a recession and how we're going to keep the mill running, a major quality problem with a customer, how are you going to resolve that, those challenges are resolved with a thoughtful approach, objective reasoning, and being honest and transparent. If it's my fault, accept the fault, correct the problem, and go forward. And I think that was it's the approach to handling the challenges that's important, because there are always going to be challenges. It's how we accept those and go forward.
Let's explore that balance thing a little bit more. I know I have young people work for me today, and they're getting instruction in university about balance in their life. And when I talk to people your age and my age, we're both well over 50, we all regret that we didn't put more balance in our life younger. But But maybe I am going to pull a story out of your past that I remember that I heard you tell at a student summit meeting a number of years ago, that about another young person who went to work at the same mill you did, and in the first year or two kind of took it easy, and you always felt that person made a mistake, or you said at that time that you thought that person had made a mistake because they were always kind of then. They never moved ahead in their career. They just kind of got off to a bad reputation in their first year or so, and you kind of hit the ground running. Can you mix all that together and tell us with the wisdom of today what you think about that?
I remember what you're talking about, and I've got I guess you'd call it a saying, that the first day on the job is the most important, the first week on the job, the first month, the first year. We never get an opportunity to make a good first impression. We've got to make that good first impression. So I don't condone laziness or slacking off at all, but it's the staying at the office the extra hour or 2 hours when you're really not doing anything, but you think it's important, and there's a part of that in my case tended to be selfish. Nobody else can do it as good as I can, so I got to be sure that it, you know, that it's done correctly or that it gets done, and that's not a good philosophy. I think there is pressure today from some corporations on their young employees. In fact, I've heard recently where some supervisors have told the young employees, I expect you to work 10 to 12 hours a day, and that's just not realistic. If we've reached the point in life where we're so thin on people to exist, you know, to make the profit, then something's wrong. We can't continue to do that. We burn out people. We're not designed to work that many hours a day. We're designed to rest 8. We're designed to work 8. We're designed to eat and hygiene for 3 or 4, and we're designed to take care of personal life for 3 or 4, and that's 24 hours. We got the schedule in balance at 24.
Yeah, very important. Very important. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with David in a minute and let him rest his voice, and we'll come back and work on him some more.
Do you need to maximize your mixing capabilities? Philadelphia Mixing Solutions mixer drives are specially designed to handle the rigors of mixing for the pulp and paper industry. With proven technologies for top entry and aeration, our total systems approach provides cost-effective solutions to maximize stock dispersion and degassing. For more information on our mixer and aeration products, contact us today at 717-832-2800 or philamixers.com.
ESCO traces its history back to 1939. ESCO knows everything there is to know about doctor blade holders, and complete doctoring systems. They are located in modern facilities in Green Bay, Wisconsin. You can learn more at www.escoincorporated.com. That's www.escoincorporated.com. Or, if you prefer, phone them at 1-920-494-3480. That's 1-920-494-3480. Tell them you heard about them on Pulp and Paper Radio International.
Well, we're back with David Ashcraft, and been talking about balance in career and life. Let's move on. David, how have major or historic events impacted the industry, or how did they specifically impact your business where you've been in places in life?
You know, as I reflect on that question, I think for the most part, our industry has followed a fairly simple principle, and that is products are manufactured where the perceived costs are lowest, and then they're sold where the perceived revenue to create the margin is highest. Historically, that's meant that our industry came from the north, midwest, down to the south, and in the 60s, 70s, a lot of expansion in the south, and then more recently, we've seen our industry migrate to south of the equator, South America, and to Asia. I think those are natural occurrences. Those of us that are impacted when the industry changes location feel hurt, we feel neglected, we feel like somebody's taking advantage of us. But I think those are natural occurrences for the particular grades that that many of the mills make in the South. Packaging, I think, is still a great business for the Southeast U.S. I think tissue, which tends to be a local manufactured product, is still a good business. Paper's declining, and of course, newsprint is declining. But if you look at the infrastructure that we have in forest products in the Southeast with our pine forest, the transportation system, the mills we have, I think we're still very competitive in packaging, and then, of course, tissue, I think we're competitive.
Yeah, tissue doesn't transport well, obviously.
It does not.
And so it needs, and everybody uses 30 pounds a year, so that's a pretty predictable business there.
Yeah. Now, you know, one comment, I just returned from an 8-day trip to India, and in northeastern India, almost no paper products whatsoever there. And one of the things that I noticed is that newsprint is being used there. I don't know that it's been manufactured in India. I suspect it's being imported from other parts of the world. But it's interesting to see an economy that is young, so to speak, growing, or low GDP as it's growing, and as the hygiene products come in, as paper comes in, as newsprint comes in. And one of the questions I was thinking about, even though I saw the newspapers, is that short-lived, and the iPhone and the smartphones and the tablets, the computers, you know, going to knock that out before it has a chance to do anything. But I know, but it was interesting to see that over there.
I think that's very true, and I think from what we've studied here at Tallow Analytic in China, they skipped the newspaper, or at least the widespread distribution of newspapers, and went straight to electronics. India, being an older country with some infrastructure, it's different. But I've always noticed, and I think you're agree with me, that when a low GDP economy starts to rise, one of the first things of luxury, and we would laugh about it here in the United States, but one of the first things of luxury is things like tissue for hygiene. It's one of the very first products that comes into a low GDP country.
Where I was located in the villages, and even in the couple of the office buildings in one of the capitals, there was no toilet paper available.
Yeah,
that struck me. You know, I've never been in a place where it was like that. But
yeah,
I learned.
yeah, I understand. Yeah, we take so much for granted here.
Yes.
Can you think of any? Were there any historical events that while you were managing a mill that caused a disruption or something? I don't know. You were probably in middle management at the time, but the great inflation of the late 70s and early 80s had a huge impact on any kind of business. Maybe that would be something you remember or something else.
During that period of time, we had price controls. One illustration of that, we had price controls, but the price controls did not impact the price for rejects. So a lot of us for a period of time there could sell rejects for a higher price than we could sell good production, and that created some horrible work habits that were difficult to undo later on. But the inflationary period, the continuous salary increases. I can remember salary increases of 10% and the impact of those expectations on negotiations. And when inflation was finally reduced and we finally started seeing the impact of that in negotiations, we had a pretty difficult period there going through labor relations to keep expectations in line with where the economy was headed.
So in summary, the way the economy was going, your people were trained to make rejects and expect a 10% raise a year.
Yeah, to both things, you know, just defying economics and everything. So the carrot, you know, and you reward people based on those sorts of things. I think another thing that really hurt our industry through those 60s and 70s was the emphasis on volume as opposed to an emphasis on quality. And in many cases, particularly at the lower levels of the mill, almost no emphasis on profitability. You know, all the reward systems were based on tons per day. And there's something to that, but if you don't balance that with an emphasis on quality and profitability, you're out of balance and quickly start making the wrong decision.
As far as technology, tell us how you stayed ahead of the curve personally and when you were managing businesses, as there's certainly been a lot of technology change on every level in the time you've been had your career.
Yeah, and I mentioned three of those that impacted Evadale. The first machine was 1954. And we were a bleached board machine, and that the initial machine came online at a time when consumer products such as cups, folder, plate, a lot of conveniences were being developed, and we were in the forefront of that, and I think read the market correctly. We rode the wave of high quality there for a period of time with greeting cards. IBM was a major customer. So in terms of products, the initial machine and first few years of operation, I think they were in the forefront. Later on, we were in the forefront of we did not have enough hardwood for our mill, so we, along with a couple of others, developed the technology to pulp sawdust and use it as a substitute to hardwood, and were relatively successful with that. A third area where we were at the forefront, we had either the first or second displacement bleach plant in U.S. The bleach plant ultimately was not successful. But I think that dampened our appetite to be at the forefront of some of the innovation. In the latter years, we tried to be a quick number two as opposed to the number one with innovation.
Now that old saying in the industry, nobody wants serial number one.
Hey? Right.
Want number two, right.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Number two, from our perspective, tended to be the best position, particularly when we just had the single mill, and we didn't have a backup in terms
right.
of provided products if something failed.
Right, yes. In your opinion, what's the future of the industry?
I think the industry's future is great. I have thoroughly enjoyed the industry. I've been a proponent of it since 1964. I still am. It's changing. It's different. And if we're not willing to change and adapt, then there are going to be some rough times. I think we've stabilized in terms of production. I'm guessing 70-80% of our peak. I think there's some opportunities to innovate. I think the demand for a long fiber pulp is good, and that benefits the South. Here at NC State, there are lots of students right now. We've probably got as many students as we've had 10 or 15 years ago. One of our students had 12 job offers last year, which is entirely too many, but almost all our students have multiple offers, and it looks like that situation is going to continue for a while. So right now, I'm very high on the industry.
Good. And so you would a young person came to you today and said, should I get in pulp and paper? I think you would say yes.
I say absolutely yes, but it needs to be at NC State. I'm a little biased there. But I think it's very important I think the engineering undergraduate degree is very important. And then so a strong degree there, BS in paper science and a BS in chemie, which is, you know, what you get at NC State, you know, that real strong foundation in engineering. And then I like an MBA somewhere along the way, not necessarily right after the the early college, undergraduate days, maybe a little work experience, and then get an MBA, because I do think we need some management skills that complement the engineering degree.
I agree with you on that. I've been railing. Well, if you go back, like in the span of your career, there was a lot of technology involved, technology changes, and there was a time when a mill could succeed as just keeping up with technology. But in a mature industry now, it takes a lot of business savvy all over the spectrum to be
right.
Yes, I agree with that.
And the other thing you get with the MBA is that you get the association with other people in other industries and learn what works for them. And I think that's one of the advantages of the MBA after the employee has a little bit of on-the-job experience himself or herself.
Well, I know you've been the executive director there at the foundation at NC State for the last few years, but it seems like you're getting ready to move in a new direction. What are you up to, and what you going to do going forward?
Yeah, I think I'll be here probably less than a year now. We have a new chancellor, a new dean, and I'm 66, so it's time for me to do other things. And I'm looking at doing some volunteer work for the Baptist Men of North Carolina. They have missions throughout the U.S. That's one of the chief groups that responds to disasters here in the U.S. And then they are big sponsors of mission projects like I just went on in India. So starting sometime next year, I won't be working for money, but I intend to stay busy, keep working. And I've got, 9 grandkids now. So I enjoy the grandkids. And I want to do a little coaching of other people as appropriate and maybe as needed.
I was going to ask you what your priorities are going forward, but it sounds like you got at least 9.
They're 9, and they're also a money drain. That's the bad problem. But they're enjoyable.
Well,
in terms of just, you know, one sentence summary, what do I remember of the industry? It's people like you, it's people like Woody Rice, Jim Ferris, people like that I remember, and the relationships that count at the end of the day.
Wow. Well, thank you very much, David. It's been a great pleasure talking to you, and I'm sure that our listeners, both online and will be archiving this for future listening, and I'm sure it'll be of great benefit, and we'll let folks know how to get a hold of this. This is one in a long series, we hope, of audio histories of people who have been great leaders in the industry. In our industry. So, David, thank you very much, and it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to our show today. We appreciate your support. Make sure you are always reading the highest-ranked e-newsletters in the worldwide pulp and paper industry. That would be globalpapermoney.com and nipimpressions.com. This program has been produced by Pulp and Paper Radio International, a subsidiary of Paparitalo Publications, Duluth, Georgia, in the United States. Copyright 2012, all rights reserved. And remember, whatever you do, please do it safely. We'll be talking to you soon. ¶¶